Well, folks, I think we're going to get started here this morning. We don't have a quorum, so we can't officially start, but I want to give Chair Sundin the opportunity to start talking about his bill, and we'll have a conversation. It seems like a lot of folks are late this morning, and it's only Tuesday. So for those chairs that have meetings that start at 8 o'clock on Thursday and Friday, I wish them well and hope that the folks actually show up. So Representative Sundin, if you'd like to start telling us about about your bill, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1628 deals with an election. Let's call it a debacle. Let's call it a situation that absolutely needs to be fixed as soon as possible. What this bill does, it extends the allowable length of the special election cycle for a vacant legislative seat by 2 weeks. In cases where the special election is expedited in order to seat the person elected immediately to allow that person's participation in the legislative session. Okay. What happened was a perfect storm against democracy, let's say it. When the appointment of then Senator Lori to the HHS commissioner's position caused a vacancy up in the 11th Senate District, the wheels were set in motion and for this special election, and they were up against many, many barriers for a fair and open election. And that was a compressed timeline that's prescribed by statute here in Minnesota. And we had a holiday that entered into this that delayed some of the mailing process. We had actually the weather delayed mail up in the northern parts of the state. That doesn't happen too often. We should have the Pony Express service going because they never fail. But that didn't happen. And it's just a shame. At the end of the day, there were 400 ballots that didn't make the deadline due to those obstacles. And the results of the primary election still remain uncertain because those 400 votes were not counted. They could have swayed the primary election process up in Carlton, Pine, and Kanabec counties. So democracy certainly wasn't well served by the current statute. So at the end of the day, we consulted with the Secretary of State's office, and to their credit, they came up with a solution here. That's 1628. And are we going to wait to move the amendment in the bill?
Well, actually, we just...
Where do you want me to sing?
Got to a quorum, oh. But I don't see Connie now.
Well, you still have a quorum.
Okay. There she is. So we'll open this, officially open the meeting, and we will move 1628 before us and hold it over for possible inclusion. And I will also move your A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment delineates the responsibility of the state for reimbursing the local municipalities and counties for special elections that are caused by such a vacancy that I just described. That is the amendment.
Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape you want it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, 1628 is the remedy for to prevent such a debacle that we experienced up in Carlton County. We have Secretary of State Steve Simon here to comment on the bill.
Please come forward and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thank you, members and Mr. Chair.
Representative Sundin teed it up nicely. I just want to say I don't think there are any bad guys here. When the legislature passed this bill several years ago, I assume its rationale was that during the legislative session, you don't want a day longer than necessary to go by with the people of a district not having representation. So the idea was to do a very compressed, very hurried timetable. That's not a bad impulse. But I think what we saw in the Senate District 11 election was that 35 days is just too short, especially when there's a competitive primary, especially when, as here, you have a lot of jurisdictions that vote by mail only, which is generally something that's tempts fate when it comes to timelines. But here you had the situation of the Duluth sorting facility for the U.S. mail had been closed a couple years ago. So now if you live in Carlton County, for example, and you want to mail a letter to someone across the street from you, it's not going to take a day or two. It's going to take three or four or more days because that mail now has to go down to the Twin Cities and then back up again to Carlton County. That wasn't the case a couple years ago. So when you have a lot of jurisdictions that vote by mail and you have this kind of mail delay, and we had the polar vortex, which delayed all of the U.S. mail in Minnesota one day, and we had a holiday, President's Day, where there was no mail, you have a lot of people who are potentially or actually disenfranchised. I should note that the author of this bill in the Senate is newly minted Senator Rarick, so he agrees as well that this is something that has to be remedied. So we appreciate your support for this. I think it's common sense. We're always trying to find the balance here between getting good folks of a particular district represented as soon as possible, but we also don't want to do that at the cost of shutting people out. This seems to be a happy medium where during a legislative session you can really accommodate modern realities without kicking anyone out.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Secretary. Do we have some questions? Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, there is no perfect world. It seems like the legislature kind of wants to, when a situation happens and they did, and members don't feel that, it could have gone smoother, could have gone better, boy, that was a rough patch, and I'll go back to precinct caucuses of 2016. Next thing you know, we have a presidential primary. We have a situation where weather, not in our control, holiday, not in our control, a senator choosing to leave an elected position to assume another position, not within our control. So are we trying to manage something that's unmanageable? Because the next time we have a special election, then there's going to be another whole set of things. And you and I have been down this road a number of years trying to, quote, unquote, perfect the process. But there's no perfect way. What problems do we create by doing it this way? What problems do we solve? I guess I don't really see a difference. And it's really a hot-button issue every time you have a new governor coming in, because the governor tends to try to pick members from time to time from the House or the Senate to help fill cabinet positions or key positions. That's going to be a perennial type of activity. And I don't know that we can't pass in the state of Minnesota a law that says during even number or odd-numbered years following a gubernatorial election, weather shall not be a factor. I mean, how do we put in the statute these kinds of things and really develop good policy without jumping from election to election?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll. Excellent and fair question. And you and I, for example, worked for a long time, remember, on the vacancy and nomination question, trying to get it just
remember
right.
Remember it well.
You and I will never get those hours of our lives back, right? Trying to find that sweet spot, that balance. I mean, to be candid, I don't see any, maybe others do, I don't see any disadvantage to elongating the period in terms of the logistics, the mail. The only kind of value on the other side would be it's two more weeks that the people of a particular district go unrepresented. I just have to be candid about it. That is a downside that someone could see. I don't think it outweighs the good side, but you know, if the value is, hey, in a legislative session we don't want a day to go by longer than necessary where the good folks of a particular district are unrepresented, you are giving that up. You're saying that for two more weeks they're going to go unrepresented, and I acknowledge that. But I think it's worth it. I think Senate District 11 is not unlike a lot of Senate districts, and even if we didn't have polar vortex, even if we didn't have a mail holiday, even if we didn't have the sorting facility issue in Duluth, 35 days is really tight, especially because the rule in Minnesota is, as you know, that when you vote by mail, either because you're in a mail-only jurisdiction, or you just choose to. You order the ballot at home, and you just that's the way you vote. The rule in Minnesota has always been it's got to get there by election day, not postmarked. There are a few states that are postmarked, and that's always going to be an issue. And I think what we've learned, at least I did, is that 35 days is just too tight. It just is, regardless of circumstances. But I acknowledge that there's a trade-off, and the trade-off is somebody in a district is going to go two more weeks without having a vote in a chamber in the legislature.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Secretary Simon, I respect your position on that, but I don't necessarily agree with it, because what happens if we're in a situation where we have to have a special election in, say, the month of May, in an odd-numbered year, where the House and or Senate is very, very close like it is right now in the Senate? The people's business in the state of Minnesota could go undone past adjournment date, and then we're forced to a special session. I suspect we'd be back here the next session going, system's broken, we got to fix it again. That extra 2 weeks, we could have finished business. Now look at all this kind of stuff that we have to do, and look at how people were inconvenienced. And literally, in some chambers, you could not get business done because you could be at a 33-33 split waiting for that to happen, and we could be in complete paralysis in the state of Minnesota because we can't legislate for every particular situation.
Secretary Simon.
Well, Representative Driscoll, I mean, reasonable minds can disagree. I come out on the side of, look, it's worth an extra bit of time in order to make sure that we don't have what Representative Sundin described, which is true, 400 people who didn't get there in time, 400 ballots that came in after the deadline. We don't know how they voted. We'll never know how they voted. It could have changed an outcome. This is in the primary now, not in the general. It could have changed an outcome, and the access issues really do concern me, and I know Representative Sundin and now Senator Rarick as well. So, like a lot of things, it's a judgment call. The bill is before you. The trade-off that's being proposed here is more time for voters at a cost. We have to acknowledge the cost, at a cost of some extra days of people not having representation. That is the trade-off. I mean, let's just be honest about it. And reasonable people can differ, but this is where Representative Sundin and I and Senator Rarick land.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Secretary Simon, I don't mean to be argumentative, and you're right. Reasonable and rational people can agree and disagree on things. And I've been watching the average daily population in the House this session, and we've been at between 121 and maybe about 128 members. So there's constantly members who are not there. In this particular case, the new senator was a seated member of the Minnesota House. And so what you're doing is you're saying it's really going to be 4 weeks then before the legislature could be up and running, given what happened in District 11. Because you'd have 2 weeks on the senatorial race and 2 weeks on the House race, which can only times two the paralysis or potential paralysis of the state of Minnesota getting work done. In a scenario where you've got tight majorities and minorities in the respective chambers. And again, no one would have thought 2 years ago when we were working our 3 years ago vacancy and nomination, or 4 years ago, that, well, we have to plan for what happens if it happens over President's Day weekend and there's a mail shutdown and there is this and there is that. We can never, ever speculate and hit all potential outcomes or scenarios. I just really think that we want to move at a snail's pace on making some of these kinds of changes until we actually get very good data to look at it. Again, I don't disagree that putting some time in it, the last thing I want to do, and ever since I've been here, is to disenfranchise voters in any way. But I also think that we've got a situation where I don't want us to react within 3 weeks of the election because all of a sudden, here we go. I think we want to maybe let it simmer a little bit and see where we're at and address it at some point when we get more information on what are some of the other possibilities that we could be looking at. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. You have one other testifier as well?
I do not, but in front of you, okay. You should have a letter, Mr. Chair.
Okay, hope members will be able to look at that closely. Representative New. And we have three other bills to get to, and I want to get out of here by 9:30. So
great, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I echo Representative O'Driscoll's comments. I think we all see an issue here. I also have some concern about rushing into policy that may not be the best policy. And, you know, particularly with this recent special election we had, that there were some significant issues, one of which I don't see addressed in the language of this bill, and that is, and in fact, it's in the testimony from Michelle Lee, which I appreciate. She says, you know, there was no mail delivery on Martin Luther King Day, a federal holiday, just one day before the primary, further delaying ballots that were cast. One of the reasons current statute does not allow an election so close to the holiday, and Mr. Cook found it in statute for me. It says specifically, a special election must not be held during the 4 days before or the 4 days after a holiday as defined in section 645.44, subdivision 5. So it doesn't specify here that special election, whether that's a primary or a general election. And so I guess I would be curious as to your thoughts on how to address that. And the fact that it probably should be addressed and clarified.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New. That's a great point. It does refer to a general election. That's the way it was understood by the governor's office. That's been the legal interpretation. But I think you're right to say that either as an amendment to this bill or as a separate bill, we ought to clarify that it includes a primary, that you shouldn't be able to have a primary on a Tuesday after a federal holiday, whether it's President's Day, Martin Luther King Day, Veterans Day, any other day. I would absolutely support that. So you're right to point that out.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my question is then, how do you foresee this working with the time limitations and holidays? How does that play out? Because certainly we don't want to shorten up these already short time frames. I mean, we're already against the clock on these things. How does that play out when there is a holiday?
Yes.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative New, great question. So every time this comes up, a special election of any kind, you know, the governor's office makes the call. We don't. We advise them of the law. We advise them of the dates. We advise them of conflicts and pitfalls, but ultimately it's their call. One way to have avoided this would have been simply in SD 11 to schedule the entire election a week later. A week earlier would have been too tight and probably drastic in terms of filing periods, but a week later that might have avoided all this without throwing anyone under the bus. I'll just say that outcome might have been avoided. But I think generally speaking, I would say this. You know, Representative Sundin obviously is recounting what he called the perfect storm in SD 11. And Representative Driscoll is correct to say we shouldn't legislate by anecdote. I guess my position is that SD 11, while it had some features to it that were quite unique, illustrated the possibility that this could repeat. And I'm not talking about polar vortex. I'm not talking about a holiday even. I'm saying that in many of your districts, even a suburban district like my former district, which has no mail-only precincts, where mail service is 1 or 2 days, I think it's just too short, 35 days, especially when you have a primary. The result doesn't end up being certified until the Friday, two Fridays before the Tuesday, so that would be, what, 11 days before. So that means counties, under any circumstance, rain, shine, polar vortex, holiday, only have 11 days to print ballots, mail ballots to people who, just like any of us, can ask for the ballot at home and then make sure they get it in time to mail it back in time. It's just too tight. So your points are well taken, and I'm really interested in your point about the holiday. I think it's a very good one. And thank you for flagging that.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Any other questions from members? Any public testimony individuals would like to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we will lay 1628 over for possible inclusion in omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
And Representative Bernardi, have you looked at the minutes?
Actually, I haven't, to be honest.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
I reviewed the minutes, and I would like to move approval of the minutes from February 27th.
Okay. All in favor of approving the minutes from February 27th, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. The minutes have been approved. And I'm sorry. Any no votes on the minutes? No votes. Thank you. I think what we'll do is, since you're here, Representative Bernardi, I think what we'll do is we'll let other individuals from outside the committee. So, Representative Freiberg, are you ready to present your bill? Chair Freiberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Sure. Does it need to be moved or anything?
Oh, well, I think the plan is to lay it over for possible inclusion.
That sounds great. So House File 1152 is a bill that will increase access to voting for Minnesotans with a disability. The bill would allow county auditors to send a voter with a disability their ballot and ballot materials electronically, the same way our military and overseas voters are able to now. It goes one step further by allowing the voter with a disability to also mark their ballot electronically using whatever access technology they use. The voter would then print their marked ballot and send it back to their local election office, and there's still a paper trail. There is no transmitting a marked ballot back electronically. This is about giving voters with a disability equal access to the ballot. As you know, we have no excuses absentee voting in Minnesota. In the 2018 general election, there were 24% of Minnesotans that took advantage of voting absentee. There is a problem. The paper ballot mailed to those who live in mail ballot precincts or who want to vote absentee is not accessible to blind, low vision, and other voters with print disabilities. You and I are able to receive our ballot at home, mark it, and go on with our day. Voters with a disability sometimes need assistance, taking away the right to vote privately and independently. This bill would allow those voters equal opportunity to mark their ballots privately and independently at home, just as others can. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act requires that voters with disabilities must be provided an opportunity to exercise their right to vote that is equal to the opportunity provided to voters without disabilities. And we see this in other states that have had lawsuits. Courts are interpreting that to mean that states must provide an accessible way for blind, low vision, and other print disabled voters to mark their ballot privately and independently at home too. And Gesundheit, Representative New. When an accessible way to vote is not provided, and as a result, a voter with a disability must arrange travel to a remote elections office or an office an hour away in order to vote privately and independently, the opportunity they've been provided to exercise their right to vote is not equal to the opportunity provided to voters without disabilities who are able to mark their ballots at home. So I believe Secretary Simon is here to speak on this as well, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. I think we'll hold off questions. Secretary Simon, if you'd like to come down, state your name, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. And I don't just want to repeat, except to say that this is something that we discussed in our Disability Advisory Committee, which we have in our office. We meet quarterly with a broad cross-section of the disability community, and this has come up for a number of years. Again, just to reemphasize, this is the same procedure we already allow for overseas and military voters. So whether it's someone in the military or an exchange student in London or a 3M employee in Singapore, we already allow them to receive their ballot electronically. No one in Minnesota is allowed to send it back electronically. This wouldn't change that either. You always got to have paper, so you got to print it out once you receive it on your end. This would just add the modification that they're able to do it using particular devices or technology that are out there that allow them to mark their ballot in private the way any of us are able to do who aren't voters with a disability when we vote. This would still maintain a paper trail. This is still what we do for overseas and military voters. And I should add one other thing, too, that's important. If we don't do something like this, we face the threat of litigation. We face the threat of being sued. There have been other lawsuits in other states. There are some test cases going on right now. And so I would advise that if for no other reason, we do that, because there's a federal law that seems to control here, And this is a common sense modification, one supported broadly in the disability community. It extends virtually the same courtesy that we extend already to our overseas and military voters. I just will point out, too, that, you know, voting from home, voting by absentee, is increasingly popular. In 2013, the legislature, including Representative Driscoll at the time, passed the law for no excuses absentee voting. And since then, the percentage of Minnesotans who have chosen to vote by absentee, chosen to vote on a day other than Election Day, has skyrocketed. It used to be, on average, maybe 7, 8, maybe 9% in a stretch year, because you had to give an explanation or an excuse for voting. You had to sign under penalty of perjury that you were either going to be out of town or you were too sick or disabled to show up in person. Now we don't have that requirement. So now in the last election, last fall, it was 24%. I predict that number will continue to climb as Minnesotans across the board, whether they're voters with disabilities or not, basically say, look, I don't want to be told that I can only vote on a given day in a given physical place during given hours. I want to vote on my own timetable. So more and more we're going to see people voting from home or voting absentee, and this is a way to accommodate voters who have a disability. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. Any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon. I was just reminiscing about the work we were doing as Representative Simon, so pardon me. Just a question on lines 1.20 and 1.21. It says that the ballot needs to be returned to the county auditor in a sealed envelope. Is that a sealed envelope that is the one that would be given to all absentees, or is that I have a leftover envelope in my drawer at home in my desk and I want to put it in and I want to return it?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, it's the former. Yes, it's not just any old business envelope that you buy at Target.
Or any other buying retailer in the state of Minnesota.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Do you believe, Secretary Simon, that that language might benefit by being clarified as to what type of sealed envelope?
Mr. Secretary.
Yeah, I would say this, and actually the author, Representative Freiberg, helpfully pointed out, I believe it's sufficient in line 1.10. The reference to 203B.21 subdivision 3 does make clear what kind of, if you look at the statutory citation, it makes clear what kind of envelope regime we're talking about. But I defer to the author whether he thinks that belt and suspenders sort of language would be helpful here. I defer to him.
Chair Freiberg?
I don't have any objection to working on that if it's determined it needs to be clarified. But as Secretary Simon said, I feel like the cross-reference in line 1.10 is likely sufficient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Secretary Simon, how would this be returned? Is it presumed U.S. mail, or is there other mechanisms that could be used to return that to the appropriate county auditor?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Driscoll. Typically, it's U.S. mail, but it could be some other service. Actually, this is a nice meeting of the minds between this and the last bill, because there were people in Senate District 11 who, knowing about the delays in the U.S. mail, for FedEx or UPS or some overnight service, so some courier service. It need not be U.S. mail. It can be something else.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't mean to make this next statement is not to be humorous by any stretch of the imagination. Could you hire an Uber or a Lyft driver to come to your home, pick it up, and deliver it to? I mean, is that within a delivery service? And the reason I ask this is because folks are going to want to have a comfort level with this. And as you say, if there's potential for pending litigation, let's take care of the definitions and get those things tightened down so that we don't give people reasons and excuses to want to delay something if, in fact, it is good public policy.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I'm just looking to my left at the two brains of the operation here who could maybe help me out with that challenging but fair question. Thank you. Ms. Strother informs me that it has to be a package delivery service, so I don't think that an Uber or Lyft, and that would make sense to me now that I think about it, because we have rules in Minnesota about being an agent for delivery of an absentee ballot. Sorry to take this detour, but many of you have read recently about the alleged misconduct in North Carolina where people were collecting hundreds of absentee ballots from people. We have a law in Minnesota that limits that number to three. You can only be an agent for three people. So what happened in North Carolina or allegedly happened could not happen, at least not legally, in Minnesota. So that would make sense that you couldn't just give it to a buddy or an Uber driver. It has to be a certified service.
Representative Driscoll.
I think this will be my last question on the topic today.
Two more bills, yes.
This will be my last. Well, Mr. Chair, I understand that you want to move things, but my experience has been with election law. We want to get it right, and we want to move it because people trust the integrity of what this committee and the legislature does on that to preserve our rights to vote and our processes. So I thank you for the opportunity to continue to ask questions. I guess, Secretary Simon, my last question is, if it is the physical envelope that comes from the auditor's office, but yet the ballot is being sent electronically, how does one get that physical ballot when they receive, or that physical envelope when they get a electronic ballot?
Mr. Secretary.
Well, yeah, that can be, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll. If they have already signed up to vote by absentee, they can get that ballot mailed to them. Or, I'm sorry, not the ballot, the envelope mailed to them.
Representative.
Just for clarification, if the statute change that's being proposed allows a ballot to be delivered electronically, there'll be two communications that will be coming to the individual or two correspondents, one the physical envelope, the second the ballot.
I'm sorry, maybe I misspoke. Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, no. I was talking about the envelope, not the ballot. No, the ballot would be delivered electronically, just like we do now for overseas and military voters.
And then, Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Where does one get the physical approved envelope if the ballot and things are being delivered electronically to be able to, that's my question, that they receive two correspondents?
Right, Mr. Secretary. Yes. Yes, the county, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll. Yes, I'm sorry. I was confused. Yes, the county auditor sends a pre-stamped envelope to that person. So, yes, there are two communications.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for clarification on a previous point on the return of the absentee ballot, in Section 203B.08, it says the voter may designate an agent to deliver in person the sealed absentee ballot return envelope to the county auditor or municipal clerk. So going on, we might want to clean up that language about you know, who exactly can deliver that, because according to that language, it does sound like we could designate an Uber driver to deliver our ballot. So that you might want to look at that and consider cleaning that up a little bit. But my question is, you know, I actually think this is a really interesting piece of legislation. My late husband had ALS. He was effectively paralyzed, but he used his eyes and eye gaze technology to function on a computer. However, my question is, since these ballots then will be marked on a computer and printed at home, presumably they will look different than a standard ballot. Is that correct, or is there some, I assume that'll be different paper. I mean, I assume you're not regulating what paper they are printed on, et cetera. So will that ballot look different than a standard ballot?
Mr. Secretary or Chair Freiberg?
Mr. Chair and Representative New, yes, it could look different. That's true.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question then on that front is, certainly we want accessibility. I mean, again, this is one of the most sacred rights we have as Americans. However, I'm a little concerned about the anonymity of the ballot. And particularly, I mean, you've got some rural precincts where everyone knows everyone, and you're going to get maybe one ballot, maybe two ballots that look different from all of the others. Is there a mechanism in place to protect the anonymity of the voter?
Mr. Secretary.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative New. In fact, we're going to be discussing that, I believe, on one of the other bills that's going to be coming up today, Representative Bernardi's bill. So we thought about this a lot, we meaning not just our office, but the Disability Advisory Council that we convene quarterly. So we meet at least quarterly, at least four times a year in our office with a broad cross-section, and some of the folks who are regular attendees are here today. And the workaround that we've come up with for that issue across the board is this. Any time that a ballot is printed that looks different, either for disability purposes or any other purpose, the rule will be that the only time that would ever really come up is in a recount, where you're looking at all the physical paper ballots again and recounting. So in the case of a recount, no election judge or no personnel who had anything to do with that precinct is allowed to have anything to do in the recount. That way, no one can say, oh, yeah, the one printed on pink paper or the one that was printed on a different size piece of paper, that was Jerry's ballot. We all know Jerry's the only voter with a disability in this precinct. That can't happen. That connection can't be made. And that is something that has been blessed broadly by the disability community, many of whom are here today and were part of those considerations. So that's the workaround. It's a give and take. There's no question about it, but you're trading accessibility, and you're not really giving much up on the other side. You have that workaround so that the anonymity can be protected.
Representative Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you walk me briefly through the process then when that ballot is received? That identity obviously needs to be matched. Absentee ballots tend to be very secure. That's all right. But can you walk me through that process a little bit? Because obviously identity has to be matched when we receive absentee ballots. That process is among the most secure of our voting process. When a ballot is received by the county auditor or the municipal clerk, what is then done with that ballot? It is, the identity is confirmed. Who then views that ballot? I mean, is there a way, I suppose you have the inner envelope and the outer envelope. Is that the idea that,
yes,
that someone different, you'll have two different people who confirm the identity and then actually open that inner envelope? How do we, I'm not totally comfortable with the fact that we are protecting that anonymity throughout the process.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, excellent question. So I was just reminded that one other commonly employed procedure is that when, right now, for let's just talk about a military person, someone stationed in Kuwait right now who votes this way, sends it back, prints it out on pink paper, let's say. What will happen at the county auditor, because that was the only paper they could find, so it's clearly flagging that this is that ballot, this is that person, Joe over in Kuwait clearly voted for this candidate for governor and whatever his choices were. So typically what will happen is that the county auditor's office will then take those results, I don't know if transcribe is the right word, but duplicate them on a normal, regular, everyday looking ballot. They'll take Joe's, they don't know it's Joe, but they'll take the pink ballot and they'll take it and they will basically translate those onto a regular ballot. And then the pink ballot is discarded. The ballot that is actually of the regular cardstock and looks like all the rest, that's the one that is kept, and kept for 2 years, by the way. Under federal law, we have to keep those for 2 years.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, there would be multiple people involved throughout that process. So you don't have the same person checking the identity of the voter, as that same person is then not also opening the ballots.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative New, it is typically a number of people who handle the ballot, even in small counties where they only have a few people. So they go to great pains to isolate ballots from or to maintain the anonymity of the ballot or the secrecy of the ballot.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sector. And I believe you have another testifier, Chair Freiberg? Judy Sanders?
Not sure, actually. I'm not aware of one, but there might be somebody who wants to talk on it.
I have Judy Sanders on the list.
Oh, okay, sure.
If you could come down, Ms. Sanders. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Judy Sanders. I am from Minneapolis, and I am here as a member of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota. And I want to say that for a lot of years, blind people, particularly senior citizens, have found it very helpful to vote by absentee ballot. We never questioned how private it was because we never thought we had any opportunity to do it any other way if absentee was our choice. And then when we started learning that we could even have privacy in the voting booth in person, now we tend to expect to have our privacy, and like everyone else. So we appreciated this method and being able to do it through email if that's how we want to vote. So with all the ways that the military have found to do it, we look forward to doing the same thing. And I can answer any questions if there are any about what thoughts we might have had, but they're probably going to come more on another bill than this one.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Sanders. Any question from committee members for Ms. Sanders? Thank you for your testimony. Any other individuals who would like to testify on on House File 1152? Please come down. Welcome, sir. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Gene Martinez. I'm a senior advocate with the ARC Minnesota. We uphold the human rights of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I will be brief, but there are over 35 million eligible voters nationwide that have disabilities, and there's still a lot of barriers to people voting, whether that be physical accessibility, having the opportunity to register to vote, or having their vote challenged because of cognitive disabilities. So we're here today to express our support for House File 1152, and anything that can increase the accessibility of voting using technology is welcome, as long as there are safeguards. And these efforts are important to the disability community and appreciated. And the fact that there would still be a paper ballot that is sent back in the traditional way that absentee ballots are counted is commendable. So anyway, I wanted to thank Representative Freiberg and the committee for considering this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Any questions for Mr. Martinez? Okay, next testifier, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Trying to locate the mic. There you go.
Thank you. Hi. My name is Michael Malver. I am a member of the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota, and I also wanted to just say thank you for considering this bill. I don't have a lot to add that hasn't been said already. Just consider that not every blind person has somebody who can help them vote absentee, and even if they do have somebody who can help them vote absentee, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily comfortable with that person. There are households where not everybody has the same political belief, and so a person just might feel more comfortable voting independently on their own. Finding transportation can be a challenge for some people, so being able to vote from the privacy of their own home is beneficial that way. I have had instances where I've gone to a polling place, and people, though they were trained on how to use the adaptive equipment that would allow you to vote in a polling place, maybe forgot their training or needed to look for help, and I had to wait a while. Whereas if I could vote from my own equipment, from my own home that I know how to use, then I become sort of responsible, and I'm using things that I'm familiar with using. Lastly, I just want to point out that people with disabilities legally need access to the ability to the right to vote. And if you are a person with a disability living in a community that only has mail-in voting, so if there is no accessible polling place you can go to, and if we have no accessible absentee ballot, then that person will not be able to vote at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melvin. Any questions for Mr. Melvin? Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Maybe just a quick comment to the testifier talking about persons in the household who may not have the same political persuasions. I don't think that that's just in the blind and disabled community. I think that's all across Minnesota, sir, that we would see that. So,
thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Any other individuals in the audience that would like to come and testify? Great. Well, House File 1152 will be laid over for possible inclusion in Omnibus Bill.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And next, I'll call forward, Representative Hewitt on House File 839. Welcome to the committee, Representative. I suppose I'll move House File 839 in front of us, so the bill is before us, and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm presenting today House File 839. Along with it being Fat Tuesday, I brought a duel of chocolates from Apple Valley, so hopefully we can get through this quick. Anyways. This is really a great bill, as I'm over in the education committees, and we're looking for every way possible to save money here. This would allow our school boards to go ahead and make an appointment for an open board position and let that position go ahead until the next general election or when that term would be up. Currently, it basically they can do it, but then they got to call for a special election. Now, I have brought some testifiers with me today from the School Board Association, and they can go into more details on how this is, without doing this, it'll cause more cost and more problems for our school boards around the state. So have at it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent all elected school board members in the state. And today I'm here to support Representative Hewitt's House File 839. This bill would eliminate the requirement from the last session that school board vacancies would be handled by a special election. Originally, the idea was that it would provide voters with transparency and better representational democracy. What has occurred is shockingly different effect for school districts. They have to use their general education fund, which provides everything from teacher salary to school safety needs. Board member vacancies usually occur by one of four different ways: because of a death of a member, becoming ineligible, because of a resignation, or probably the most common, moving out of the district. I just passed out a copy of a document from the Secretary of State's office, and since he has been so eloquent today, I will hold up the picture version. And in it, he goes through some of the complexities that go along with the school board vacancies. Looking at the data from 2017, it would show that 28 school boards held special elections, and it occurred in 23 school districts. Now, this would include Columbia Heights, who had to deal with two separate vacancies, and Eagle Valley School District, which had three separate vacancies to deal with. Cost to the school district in 2007 raised from $3,000 in relatively small school districts to over $30,000 in a large district. Turnout in these elections was miserable. and ranged from five people in the Pine Point School District, and you have a letter from them in front of you, to a high of Wilmer, which had actually 14% of the voters turn out to vote. The idea that voter engagement and transparency has clearly not happened. Just for reference, in a normal election, as you folks know, because you are the election gurus for the House, normal voter turnout is 75% to 85%. These numbers in comparison are shockingly small. For this coming 2019 election season, we already have 12 elections for school board vacancies from 11 districts. The reason for most of these vacancies, as I indicated, were because individuals moved out of their school district boundaries. The Minnesota School Boards Association membership asks that this non-transparent and expensive system be replaced with the election system in House File 839. This would allow general education funds to be spent on students instead of elections for school board vacancies. School board members thank Representative Hewitt for his leadership and common sense solution in this bill. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Does anybody have questions for Ms. Kelleher at this time? Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading through the letter from the Pine Point Public Schools, and it shows that for that district, and I assume it's different for every district, but for that district, the total cost of the election was just under $500. Do you have an idea of what the typical cost of that special election would be? I'm assuming that the $500 is the low end, but I would be interested to know. Clearly, we've had lots of special elections for lots of things. Surely, we've got an idea of what the cost of that cost range might be.
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative New, very good question. The average is about $7,000 to $8,000. You know, our school districts across the state vary greatly. But once again, those are dollars that have to come out of the general education fund. They are not numbers that we can automatically assess to the taxpaying public, but instead come from you folks here at the legislature.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that you said specifically that the special election process is not transparent, and you believe that it would be more transparent then to have remaining school board members. Usually that there's, what, 5 to 7 members of a school board. So you believe that it would be more transparent to have the remaining 4 or 6 people make that decision for the entire school district. Did I hear that correctly?
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative New. You bring up a good point. When school districts call us about these elections and how to conduct them, we share with them that the best thing they can do with an appointment process is to take applications, to involve the community in that choice going forward. But we don't go as far as to say these elections in any way. When you have 5 people in Pine Point turning out for an election, it is difficult to believe that system we presently have works.
Representative New.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I understand that this was a unique situation where only 5 people showed up. That's clearly on the low end. However, it seems that the entire school district had the opportunity to show up. And I think that matters. I have real concerns about giving that power entirely to the 4 or 6 people who are left and not allowing the opportunity for the rest of the district to show up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, if you look at the back of the bill, it kind of goes into how the community can get involved if they don't agree with the appointment. And basically, they can petition to have that person that they've appointed left out, and then they can appoint somebody new. This is really, in $500 to that district, being on the school committees right now, that's a lot of money. And so this is really, we're doing everything we can to protect the people's pockets, especially when it comes to public schools. Representative New.
Representative Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that you bring that up, Representative Hewitt. I don't disagree. Frankly, the $500 is not a lot. It's just not. However, $7,000 to $8,000, I mean, in districts like my districts, that's the equivalent of funding for a student for the year. That is significant. However, in terms of the state budget, that's nothing. I would ask this. So, Representative Hewitt, do you know approximately how many special elections are held for school board members each year?
Representative Hewitt or Ms. Kelleher.
I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Kelleher. She does have the data on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just go through. In 2017, was really the first time this new system rolled out. We had 28 elections across the state, from Shakopee to Pine River Bacchus to Gibbon, Fairfax, Windham, to Tri-County, to Browns Valley, to Wilmer, sort of all around the state. And once again, they're starting to in that process again right now. And for 2019, we've got Faribault, we've got Forest Lake, we've got Milroy, we've got South St. Paul. So we get a variety of districts. No one plans to not be on the board or not be there when you're elected. But when, in fact, your family moves, as often happens to board members, that leaves you with an opening. And to use this sort of unique process and costly without either funding or without the seeming voter engagement school board members are looking for. And we do have public meetings where we invite the public. We actually give them time set aside in the beginning of the meeting. And certainly, as I said, the idea that you take applications for this, you bring them up. It's a community, once again, a community discussion, which is, in fact, open to every single parent, senior in the community to participate in.
Representative Nick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If 28, if we take that number and we assume the high end of the cost of a special election, that's $8,000, that comes to $224,000. So, Representative Hewitt, can I ask, is there a reason that we're not just paying for the special elections? I mean, $224,000 in the scope of the state budget is very, very small in the scope of the state budget. And I share a concern, certainly, with passing down any cost to school districts that are already strapped. But is there a reason that we're not just managing that cost rather than taking choices away from voters?
Representative Chair, Madam, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative New. We're trying to do what's best for our kids. That's what this is about, to put the money where it has to go. To waste it, not waste, but to look at cost shifting. $500, I come from the fourth largest district, Representative New, 32,000 kids. That's two people that are not going to be bused that year for that $500 that you were talking about. Doesn't mean much to most districts. And so my question is that, you know, we have to look at where we can get the most bang for our buck here and where our school districts and their voters are asking us to make this change. This just isn't out of, this came to me through the school boards, through their members, through their voters. They want to see change. They want to see dollars in those districts put to where they are in the classrooms. And to get to this, that's $500 to special ed buses. That's $500 to Catholic schools that gets bused by public school funds. That's special ed money. $500 is a lot right now. You can put it into the state budget all you want. It's another dollar that we could put towards our kids in the classroom. And that's kids across the state. That's just not public school kids. That's why I'm asking.
Representative.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's interesting that your voters would want you to take away their right to vote. My voters would not. My voters want the opportunity to cast their vote for those that they are placing in authority. I think it's really important to especially remember, with school boards particularly, they have taxing authority. And I just see this as ripe for problems when you have a school board that may be close on a vote, someone moves, well, now we get to appoint somebody who's going to vote the way we want to vote. I think that's very, very dangerous. I think that, you know, paying for elections is part of democracy. This is how we maintain our democracy. I think that this is a dangerous way to go. And I would ask members to consider that and vote no on this bill.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Kelleher, I'm wondering if you can comment, because you talk to these folks that are representing community members. I would say the school board is about as close as you get to your government. You know, these folks that are making decisions about running our schools, making tough decisions about every single penny that our schools have, because resources are so scarce. I'm really concerned with the charge that somehow Representative Hewitt is taking away people's right to vote. Will there be an election that people vote in to elect their school board members under this bill?
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Halverson. Great questions. I was asked by Representative New on what the average cost was, and that's about $8,000. But Columbia Heights ran this, and it was $30,000. And they had to do it twice in 1 year. South St. Paul is a large school district, lots of polling places, lots of election judges, and the only thing that's on the ballot is the school board member vacancy. So the driver to get people to participate well is that. Clearly, when you are talking about a high of 14% voter turnout in a state that has 75 to 85% turnout, that's miserable. This is not a system that is doing well, and we need help. And we appreciate your consideration today, members, of this issue.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Any final, anybody in the seats that would like to come down and testify in the public? Okay, final word. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. These are not easy times, and we have to do different things to help our schools any way we can. And that's what this bill is really about. It is never meant to strip anybody of their voting rights, but every dollar right now, every penny right now in the school situation counts. So that's what I feel I have to do here, and that's why I ask for you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and we will now move to Chair Bernardi, House File 1098. Welcome, Chair Bernardi. You can go ahead and move your own bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1098 to be possibly included in the omnibus.
Okay, omnibus proceed.
Bill. Okay, well, thank you for hearing our bill today. This is a bill that is about making sure that assistive voting devices found in our polling places work for voters who have a disability or anyone else that choose to vote using this machine. These machines need to be replaced. This legislation would allow assistive voting devices that are compatible with the tabulators used in the vast majority of Minnesota counties, as well as other vendors, to seek certification at the state level. Most polling places have two pieces of equipment in them. First, there's a tabulator, and We feed our ballot into. That's a machine that many of us are familiar with. The second machine is the federally required ADA compliant, which is American Disability Act compliant, assisted voting device that makes it possible for voters with a disability to mark their ballots and independently in the polling place. Most of the assisted voting devices currently in Minnesota are reaching their end of life, and voters are increasingly complaining that they aren't always functional. They are in dire need of replacement. Today, because of current law, 80 out of 87 counties are unable to replace their assistive voting devices, leaving voters who have a disability using unreliable old equipment. So this bill today, I have a testifier here, our Secretary of State, Simon, who will testify in favor of this bill.
Welcome to the committee again, and please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Well, thank you to Representative Bernardi for carrying this bill. It's really important to the vast majority of counties in Minnesota that this bill be passed as soon as possible. 80 out of 87 counties are now stuck with old and aging and soon-to-be non-serviceable equipment. 80 out of 87 counties have chosen one particular vendor. Now, my office is agnostic as to what vendor people choose. It doesn't matter to me. And we don't own a single piece of elections equipment in the Secretary of State's office. But what we do is we certify the elections equipment. We put it on the menu so that other people can choose from the items on that menu. And what they choose, that's their business, not ours. So all we do is certify the equipment. We certify it to certain standards. We only certify it, by the way, if it has first been certified at the federal level. Then and only then is it even eligible for us to certify. But this one vendor that has a large penetration in Minnesota, 80 out of 87 counties, is literally unable to even seek certification from our office, even to get on the menu, unless this bill passes. And the reason for that, as Representative Bernardi enunciated, is in this space, in this world, the two pieces of equipment that she talked about that are in every polling place in Minnesota, they have to be of the same vendors. They must be. It's not like your PC and your Mac products and they can kind of talk to one another. They can't talk to one another. So if you choose vendor A, both of your pieces of equipment have to be vendor A. If you choose vendor B, same thing, vendor C, and so on and so on. So that's why counties are stuck. They're stuck because their choice. They've chosen a particular vendor. It's not me for me to say whether that's wise or foolish. We just certify according to the standards, totally agnostic as to what they choose. But if they've chosen piece of equipment from vendor A for the one piece of equipment, that means they must. They have one option only. If they want to replace piece of equipment, the second piece of equipment, they must buy from that same vendor, and now they can't. Why? Because unless we pass this bill, we can't even seek to certify. It's not even on the menu for them to choose. Again, I want to make very clear, our office has always been agnostic as to who someone chooses. Doesn't matter to me. As long as it's certified in the state of Minnesota, go knock yourself out. Choose whoever you want. But it so happens that 80 have chosen a particular vendor, and they are stuck. If this bill does not pass, here's what's going to happen. If this bill does not pass, then it will be another election cycle that 80 out of 87 counties are stuck with assistive voting technology that they don't like. They don't like it because it's old. It's 20-year-old technology. Most of it was purchased in 03, 04, 05. It's old. It soon likely will not be serviced at all. We have stories in Minnesota, literally, of elections officials and counties going on eBay, in order to get parts for this particular piece of equipment. And they can't buy the new product because we haven't passed this bill. Only by passing this bill can we set in motion the certification process by which we can certify or not. Maybe it'll fail, but we can at least try to certify it, and if it passes, put it on the menu for counties to choose. If they choose it, great. If they don't, that's up to them. The inquiry is over for us after we certify the piece of equipment. But the fact, the practical fact of the matter is, 80 out of 87 counties will now be stuck for another election cycle with equipment that breaks down, which is far from state-of-the-art. It's 20-year-old technology. It is clunky, it is heavy, it is outdated, it is prone to malfunctioning, and they're stuck. 80 out of 87 counties are stuck. So what I ask members to do is to pass this legislation so that you can give 80 out of 87 Minnesota counties the option to go forward with equipment that will service their voters with disability. Otherwise, they will be stuck for another election cycle, and we're really tempting fate then.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Since we're getting short on time here, I'd like to call down our other testifiers, and we'll hold off on member questions till after they've come down. Ms. Sanders, Judy Sanders? Welcome to the committee, and please state your name again for the record.
Thank you. My name is Judy Sanders, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am again here with the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, and I've been doing this for many years, and I think it's the first day or hearing that I've ever been to where I testified twice on two different bills. So new things happen all the time. Part of the problem with this bill goes back in history. It was very exciting to me and other blind people and people with disabilities when, in 2006, for the first time in our lives, we could vote independently and privately at the voting place. And that happened. We have to thank Gore and Bush and all those lovely people out there who weren't quite sure who they wanted to vote for. And so they came up with the Help America Vote Act. And when the National Federation of the Blind learned about this, we said, as long as you are redoing legislation, we want to support legislation that would say that every voting precinct must have one, at least one, accessible voting procedure or machine that will serve blind people or people with disabilities. And it happened, and it was so exciting that we could actually do this by ourselves. Makes me not want to use an absentee ballot. But so we have moved forward, and in Minnesota we chose a few different machines came into being, but 80 counties chose the same machine to use, and it worked well for its time. And as Secretary Simon has told us, we are now looking at machines that are breaking down, and that they have to be replaced. So we have this problem because it has to match the tabulators. And the vendor that's making the tabulator that matches the accessible voting machine has changed their process to use a different looking ballot. So now we have the problem of having a ballot that would be recognized if it were singled out. And it'll go in the tabulator, but you could pick it out as our ballots. And so when we heard about this, we weren't very excited about that machine at first. But we also recognized that counties have invested greatly in all those tabulators. And we thought it was unreasonable to ask them to give up those tabulators unless you were going to budget a whole lot of money to replace those as well as the voting machine. So we worked with the Secretary of State's office to come up with a solution which says that if less than 10 ballots of these new ballots that we're asking you to approve or certify, if less than 10 of them are used in a precinct, then if there is a recount, and that's the only reason it would matter, if there's a recount, we have to have different election judges count the ballots in that precinct. So nobody who's watched us cast the ballot will be seeing those ballots. That was satisfactory to us because we want to be reasonable about costs involved, and we definitely don't want to give up our right to a private ballot. If it turns out that's what we have to do, we're going to ask you to do the same thing, and we'll find a way for you to do it.
Thank you, Ms. Sanders.
You're welcome.
I also have Mr. Martinez on the list to come down and testify. Welcome again, Ms. Martinez. Please state your name for the record and proceed. Yes. And if you could keep it to 2-3 minutes, that'd be great.
I will keep it short. My name is Gene Martinez. I'm a senior advocate with the ARC Minnesota. And in order to help voters overcome barriers to voting, Minnesota has a long history of providing assistive technology that supports people with disabilities in voting and also safeguarding their privacy and independence. Ballot marking machines such as the AutoMark, ImageCast Evolution, and Verity TouchWriter are important tools to ensure accessibility at the polls. After a voter inserts their paper ballot and makes choices, the machine will fill in the correct ovals and return the ballot to the person. They can use the vote tabulation machine to have their ballot counted, and as all other people do. So new accessible technology that eliminates barriers to voting and preserves the integrity of our elections is welcome and should be made widely available. That is why I'm here today to express my support for House File 1098. And again, there's a with this new technology, there's still the creation of a paper ballot that reflects the choices of the voter. So thank you to Representative Bernardi and Representative Clever for sponsoring House File 1098, and we urge your support.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez. Are there any other members from the public who would like to testify? Okay. Please come down. Yeah, we are. And usually we don't swear in my committees. That's okay.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael Malver, and I am a member of the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota. And I just really want to briefly address what I feel is a concern. Right now, we do have technology that needs to be replaced. But the beauty of that technology is that when I take my ballot, I can put it in that piece of technology, I can mark it up, and I have a ballot that looks like everybody else's. Using this new technology that we allegedly need to pass this legislation for in order to have an accessible machine, I would have a ballot that looks different. Quite frankly, I question if we were discussing any other minority group other than people with disabilities, would we be having the discussion minority group X should vote on a ballot that looks different? But setting that aside, 7 out of 87 counties in Minnesota have apparently solved this technology issue and are allowing people to vote on the ballot that currently we have. I would be interested to know how that happens. I'm also told that it would be very costly for the other 80 counties to replace their equipment. This may indeed be true, but I, for one, have not seen and maybe this is my ignorance, for which I apologize, a cost analysis showing what it would cost not only to get equipment from this vendor that can't come to the table because of a different looking ballot, but because of other vendors who are not certified but who perhaps are capable of printing on our current accessible ballot stock. Thank you. Those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Melvin. We have a couple member questions, and Secretary Simon, if you could come down, I think you might be needed to answer it. Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anyone else that would like to testify from the public? Okay. Representative Halverson, I believe you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, so I have the good fortune of getting to spend a lot of time in the Health and Human Services Committee, and we deal with disability policy a lot. And so my lens is very much focused on the way we think about disability policy in the 21st century in Minnesota, which is guided by a court decision, Olmstead, that says that people have to be able to self-determine their own lives and their own choices. And I can think of kind of no more important thing that you are self-determining than your right to vote. So, Mr. Secretary, if for some reason this bill doesn't pass, is there a concern that people won't be able to self-determine and that people with disabilities could potentially become disenfranchised if we're not able to update our equipment?
Mr. Secretary, just as a reminder, evidently rules is coming in after us, so. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson. Yeah, the danger is that these machines will simply break down or suffer a failure that is not can't be easily remedied because the part isn't available, it's not serviced, and then the person will not have a confidential voting experience. That's why the urgency here, and that's why this the Disability Advisory Council that we convene quarterly has strongly endorsed this legislation. And by the way, I should point out, this is going on 4 years in the making. I think 2015, the first year I came into this office, we had our first discussion about this. We had hands-on demonstrations where members of the Disability Council were allowed to test out the equipment, the proposed equipment. And so this has been going on since at least the summer of 2015, as I recall. And so a lot of sort of informal meetings and discussions about this as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Secretary. And Representative Mann, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary just answered my question.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary.
One other thing I can't resist, Mr. Chair and members, and President Driscoll may remember this because this issue came up when he was chairing the Government Operations and Elections Committee. This had broad bipartisan support. I think, if memory serves, it's certainly north of 100 votes on the House floor, broad bipartisan support when this was passed last year with Representative Driscoll's help.
Thank you. Representative Driscoll, you have a question?
Well, since the Secretary referenced me, I would also like to just make my own statement regarding that. This has been a long time in coming, and I, as I mentioned earlier in my comments, I'm not about disenfranchising voters, and all voters who are legal and eligible to vote should vote, and we should not put barriers in their way. The thing that's also important to remember about this system, if we do have a, as it's sometimes referred to as in legislative lingo, the skinny ballot, I think it's important to note that it is not reserved exclusively wholly to the exclusion of others, that system for being able to vote. I almost am a little hesitant to share this because it may be a fast way to be able to get in and out of the polls. If you agree to, you know, using the voter-assisted equipment, assuming that there are not others that are using it. And the thing that this really does and underscores is helps to keep the anonymity of all those who may use it who have disabilities, because it's being commingled with those people who are, again, legal voters, who have the right to vote, who are voting using that system. So if there are four or five or six people who use the assisted voting equipment because they needed it for their own individual purposes, and 30 or 40 or 50 or 100 other people have used that system, it certainly helps preserve the anonymity and gets the lines shorter for people to be able to get on after having cast their ballots that day. And we definitely do need to look at this because, again, I do not want to disenfranchise legal voters in the state of Minnesota from exercising their right to vote.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Any final comments? Chair Bernardi.
Just thank you, members, and I would love for you to sign on to this bill. It has had bipartisan support, and thank you for hearing it, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to renew my motion for House File 1098 to be considered in the omnibus elections bill.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. We will lay this over for possible inclusion. With that, we conclude our work. Yeah. Excuse me. Just as a reminder to members that we will be meeting tomorrow at 7 p.m. or the call of the chair in 500S. So with that, this meeting is adjourned.